The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the teenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. And our first article today is from the teenmagazine.com. The Future of Education Under Biden's Presidency. And this op-ed article was written by Olivia C. The Critical Situation of Education. The first few years under any presidential administration are incredibly noteworthy. It is a change for underrated victors to establish their dominance and political expertise among their equally capable peers, or for overrated ones to show how underqualified they are for their elected jobs. In the case of Joe Biden, though, it was a time for both. Many members of both the Democratic and Republican parties support his policies and ideals, while others condemn his decisions. Regarding the inflation of gas prices, his overall approval rating amongst citizens of the United States plummeted. The same could be said for his handling of the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the unpredictable rise and fall of stocks. However, an issue that the Biden administration handled with very little internal division was in the field of education. Issue at hand. Education, by nature, is a very touchy subject. It is a luxury that should be prized and taken advantage of. Many countries don't have access to it, and those that do rarely maximize its capabilities or effects. Nevertheless, according to the Biden administration, President Biden believes that a post-high school education should be prioritized, as he feels it should be a ticket to a middle-class life. He also understands, though, that student loans are a heavy debt weighing on the backs of the best and brightest Americans. To combat this issue, the administration proposed early on in their campaign to provide student debt relief. To many, it was believed to be just a promise, just a claim that aligns with the infamous triangulation strategy politicians use to get elected. However, on August 24, 2022, President Biden and his team of officials came through with their promise. Small successes. Since 1980, the cost of public and private secondary education has nearly tripled, and the debt that comes along with it has proven to be a burden on those trying to build a future and a life for their families. After debuting a three-part plan, Biden plans to target debt relief, make the student loan system less convoluted, and prevent a future debt crisis by holding public and private institutions accountable for their respective prices to learn. Joe Biden has also been able to successfully reopen the majority of primary schools for in-person learning and provide relief to schools suffering from the COVID-19 pandemic. The event initially proved to be a difficult obstacle to take on, with many schools going virtual or opting to shut down completely. Under the 46th president's guidance, these have been able to reopen with minimal health crises and repercussions and fill the vacancies left by students who changed districts or opted to drop out. The Future of Education. These progressive decisions are a change of pace from the American education system under the guidance of ex-Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, who believed in the privatization of public schools, the neglect of special education for children with learning disabilities, and the consideration of administrative gun handling within classrooms, all of which were ideas that were met with widespread disapproval and concern. Biden, however, holds more agreeable ideals and claims, and will even take the education initiative a step forward to advance educational equity. He believes he can do so by providing educators and administrative officials with the financial support to maintain consistent educational employment and supply resources necessary for adolescent learning. By creating a safe environment for teachers, a safe environment is in turn created for students and their guardians. He also hopes to address the digital divide between privileged students and students suffering from communal impoverishment and a lack of financial funding, as well as to double the number of student resource officers, psychologists, nurses, and social workers to tend to the mental and physical health of students. While these claims are extraordinarily ambitious, there is something to be said for a campaign that has strong morals and has detailed plans written out to tackle the issue facing everyday Americans. And with time ticking towards the 2024 election and Biden's approval rating continuing to change, these next few years could either make or break the future of Biden's political career and social reputation. And our next article is from TeenVogue.com. Stacey Abrams' run for Georgia governor is crucial to protect abortion rights. And this op-ed article was written by Jamila Nasheed. Remember when Georgia turned blue and we narrowly escaped another 4 years of a Trump presidency? Celebrations erupted across the country as thousands of people felt relief and hope for the first time in years. And it was widely acknowledged that a black woman from Georgia was one of the key factors in that victory. Despite losing her bid for governor in 2018, that woman, Stacey Abrams, threw her time, effort, and resources into empowering voters and advocating for candidates in 2020. She was praised for her work, and her face was everywhere, from the social media accounts of highly influential folks to the pages of magazines. Now, here we are less than 2 years later, and Abrams is running for governor again. This time around, the world knows her name, but the posts of support appear to be fewer and farther between. Abrams helped save our democracy, but will the beneficiaries of that heroism show up for her when she needs them the most? She is behind in the polls, but on the ground in Georgia, where I live, it's far too quiet. Now is the time to get loud for Stacey Abrams. In a July survey from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Governor Brian Kemp was several points ahead of Abrams. In that same survey, Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat from Georgia, was ahead of his Republican candidate. For anyone paying attention to Georgia's upcoming midterm election, this should be alarming. And for clarity, everyone should be paying attention to this upcoming midterm election. Abrams' advocacy in such a crucial swing state amounted to showing up for every person in this country during the 2020 election. Now, who's going to show up for her? As Kemp continues his reign of terror for people who want bodily autonomy, who want sensible and safe gun laws, and who want to live in a state that won't throw away opportunities for economic growth because of its leaders' oppressive personal beliefs, it's especially important to recognize that this election will directly impact the lives of millions of people in Georgia and beyond. For years, Georgia was a safe haven state for people from neighboring southern states in need of reproductive care. Unfortunately, thanks to Kemp, our state has become a place that women will now have to leave to find adequate care. A 2019 law passed by the Republican-controlled legislature and signed by Kemp outlaws abortions after doctors can detect an embryo's cardiac activity, typically about 6 weeks into pregnancy. That law was blocked by the courts, but now that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it has taken effect. Kemp made the decision to impose a strict ban on abortion access, despite the fact that Georgia has the second highest maternal mortality rate in the country and one of the highest rates of uninsured women of childbearing age, with nearly 1 in 5 women in this group uninsured. This is largely due to the fact that Georgia is one of only 12 states that has not expanded Medicaid, which Abrams plans to do. And according to a 2018 report, 76 of the state's 159 counties have no OBGYNs or psychologists, 60 counties have no pediatricians, and 9 counties have no physicians at all. Additionally, Kemp rolled out a plan that would remove Georgians from the federal health insurance marketplace. The plan would have acted as a rollback of the Affordable Care Act by allowing the state to redirect users from the official healthcare.gov site to sites that would require them to go through private insurance brokers. The country is in the midst of tackling the COVID-19 pandemic, one of the greatest health threats in our lifetime, and Georgia should be focused on improving access to health care, not limiting it, wrote Senators Warnock, Ossoff, and all 6 Georgia House Democrats. Instead, this attempt to undermine the Affordable Health Care Act and push Georgians into health plans that are less comprehensive and more expensive is callous and cruel. This waiver plan, approved by the Trump administration, would have made Georgia the first state to withdraw access to the federal health care marketplace. Fortunately, the Biden administration permanently suspended the proposal on August 9th. But this blatant disregard for the lives and health of Georgia's citizens is heartless. As a woman in Georgia, I'm now terrified of pregnancy, wanted or unwanted. The thought of enduring unnecessary obstacles during pregnancy because of restrictive and inhumane laws is horrifying. Abrams has stated that if she's elected governor, she will ensure that Georgia is a state where people have the right to choose, and that she will veto any new laws that criminalize abortion. For the millions of people who can get pregnant and live in Georgia and its neighboring states, those who want to have children and those who don't, Abrams is best for our health. She's best for our lives and whether or not we survive pregnancy. To the people who love and care for people with uteruses, this is your concern too. Our reproductive rights should be guaranteed because of the simple fact that all people deserve full bodily autonomy. Still, it's important to acknowledge the economic impact that the loss of these very human and basic rights will potentially have on Georgia's economy. As Georgia has become a hot location for high-earning tech companies and the TV and film industry, raking in billions of economy-boosting dollars, top executives are considering taking their money elsewhere. We've seen tech companies offering relocation for employees impacted by restrictive abortion laws, and industry titans like Disney CEO Rob Iger, who in 2019 said of Georgia, "I don't see how it's practical for us to continue to shoot there." Kemp cares so little about the rights of Georgia's women to be safe and healthy that he's willing to jeopardize job opportunities for Georgians and billions of dollars that would grow our state's economy. Speaking of Georgia's economy, Atlanta's Music Midtown, an annual festival that began in 1994 and generates $50 million per year, was canceled this year, reportedly because of Georgia's gun laws. Atlanta City Council President Doug Shipman tweeted, "Public policy has real impacts, and in this case, economic and social implications on a great tradition." In April, Kemp signed legislation that made it legal to carry a concealed handgun in public without a state license. This was a little more than a year after a man shot and killed 8 people, many of them Asian women, at a string of spas across Atlanta. Unlike Kemp, Abrams has committed to making progress on public safety and gun control in Georgia. The stakes shouldn't be so high, but they are. From reproductive health care and public safety to economic stability, the lives of millions of people in the Southeast are at stake. Every candidate who benefited from Abrams' groundbreaking work during the 2020 election should be shouting her name in an endorsement. Every public figure who sang her praises should be flocking to Georgia to show their support for her again. Georgia was on everyone's mind in 2020 when you needed us. Now that we need you, where are you? Now that she needs you, where are you? The donations are great, but this moment calls for more than that, because this is the time to support her, not just her labor. Everyone loves black women when we are in service to you. But when black women need you, where's that love? Where's that support? Show up for Stacey Abrams the way she showed up for you. And our next article, also from teenvogue.com, Abortion and the Midterms, Republican Candidates Are on the Defensive. And this article was written by Caleb Ikarma. And there's a note. This article was originally published by Vanity Fair. Just a few months ago, Republicans looked poised to flip the House and the Senate in a red wave fueled by Joe Biden's dismal approval ratings, rising inflation, and a stalled-out legislative agenda. But the political landscape looks significantly less favorable for Republicans these days, particularly following the Supreme Court's June decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, an issue Democrats are rallying their base around. GOP candidates across the country are apparently feeling the change in tide, going on the defensive about their stances on abortion. In California, Representatives Mike Garcia and Michelle Steele, two vulnerable Republican incumbents, recently retreated from an anti-abortion bill they co-sponsored last year by indicating their support for abortion rights in cases of rape, incest, or threats to the mother's health, according to the Los Angeles Times. Such exceptions were not included in the Life at Conception Act. Steele, an anti-abortion lawmaker with an A-plus policy rating from Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, has seemingly distanced herself from hardline abortion policies this cycle, telling the Los Angeles Times that, despite her support for the measure, conversations surrounding a nationwide ban on abortion are purely hypothetical at this point. Garcia, facing a particularly tough race after redistricting decreased the number of GOP voters in his district, has assured his constituents that the Supreme Court's decision will not change access to abortions in the state. The political recalibration is perhaps no more apparent than in Arizona Republican Senate Committee Blake Masters's campaign. After spending the contentious primary describing abortion as a form of genocide, calling abortion rights activists demonic, and claiming that the left views abortion as a form of religious sacrifice, Masters has tempered his rhetoric, telling the Arizona Republic recently that the state's 15-week abortion law is a reasonable solution, while also scrubbing a line on his campaign site, billing him as 100% pro-life. In response to media reports on the changes to his website, Masters told the local NBC affiliate that he did not remove my stance, adding, "Go look at my website. It's the most detailed, most pro-life agenda of any Senate candidate running nationwide. I'm calling for a constitutional amendment or at least a federal law." Tiffany Smiley, the GOP nominee in Washington's U.S. Senate race, also attempted to clarify her abortion stance last week, releasing an ad that declared, "I'm pro-life, but I oppose a federal abortion ban." The spot came in response to an attack ad aired by her opponent, Democratic Senator Patty Murray, claiming that Smiley is Mitch McConnell's hand-picked candidate and would support federal abortion bans if elected. In Smiley's ad, the Republican candidate insisted that she is not the anti-abortion extremist Murray has portrayed her as. However, leading up to the race's primary election, Smiley said she agreed with Texas's near-total abortion ban, which is widely considered to be among the most extreme in the country. Similarly, in Nevada's U.S. Senate race, GOP candidate Adam Laxalt published an op-ed this month saying he would not support a nationwide abortion ban, despite previously calling Roe v. Wade a joke and criticizing Nevada's lack of abortion restrictions. Laxalt still supports banning abortions after 13 weeks of pregnancy, and his campaign site states he will be a reliable vote against extreme pro-abortion laws. In the U.S. Senate race in Colorado, abortion has become the focal point after Democratic Senator Michael Bennett released a campaign ad accusing his GOP challenger, Joe O'Dea, of opposing the state's abortion protections and supporting Donald Trump's Supreme Court selections. According to Axios, O'Dea countered by declaring his support for abortions that take place within 20 weeks of pregnancy. Meanwhile, Democratic campaigns and groups have embraced pro-abortion messaging, spending $30 million on TV spots and $7 million on Facebook ads that reference the issue since the SCOTUS draft majority opinion was leaked in May, per data compiled by Ad Impact and published by CBS News. A Monday poll from NBC News showed that persuadable midterm voters broke for Democrats by 3 points, a marked improvement for the party compared to the outlet's pre-Dobbs surveys, which had Republicans leading by 6 points among those voters in March and May. Per a Pew Research Center survey published in July, nearly 6 out of 10 Americans said they believed abortion should be legal in all or most cases. And our last article today from TeenVogue.com, the Senate same-sex marriage bill will soon head to a vote. And this article was written by James Factura. And there's a note, this article was originally published by them. In the face of heightened fears that the Supreme Court may overturn marriage equality, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has announced that the Senate will vote on a proposal to codify same-sex and interracial marriage protections in the coming weeks. The Respect for Marriage Act, RFMA, has existed in various forms since 2009, but was passed by the House of Representatives this July, 1 month after the Supreme Court's June decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health overturned Roe v. Wade. The proposed legislation would officially repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, which has been unenforceable since 2015, when Obergefell v. Hodges legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. It would additionally provide protections for married couples based on sex, race, ethnicity, or national origin, legally enshrining the rights to same-sex and interracial marriage on a federal level. The day after it was reintroduced, all 220 House Democrats and 47 Republicans voted in favor of the act, though that also means that 157 Republicans opposed it. Schumer announced that the Senate would finally put the act to a vote in a Wednesday press conference, imploring people to remember why a vote on the Respect for Marriage Act is necessary, Schumer said in comments reported by ABC News. Millions upon millions of American women had their right taken away by the extremist MAGA Supreme Court in the Dobbs decision. And in a concurring opinion, Justice Thomas opened the door for the Supreme Court going even further. the RFMA has become newly relevant in the wake of the shocking reversal of Roe v. Wade, which has called Americans' fundamental rights to privacy into question. Specifically, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in a concurrent opinion that two landmark LGBTQ+ civil rights cases, Obergefell v. Hodges and Lawrence v. Texas, which legalized same-sex marriage and sodomy respectively, should also be reconsidered. When some Republicans say the vote is unnecessary, it won't happen. They said the same thing about Roe, Schumer said. But let me be clear. A vote on marriage equality will happen on the Senate floor in the coming weeks, and I hope there will be 10 Republicans to support it. In order for the RFMA to pass with the filibuster-proof majority, the legislation needs 60 votes, meaning that 10 Republicans must also vote in favor of the bill. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin, and Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, are working together to galvanize Republicans to vote in favor of the RFMA. In a recent Washington Post op-ed, the two lawmakers acknowledged that marriage is both a cultural rite of passage and a system that provides distinct legal advantages. Those systematic benefits include joint tax filing, the ability to receive spousal benefits such as Social Security, Medicare, and disability, as well as visitation rights in instances of grave illness. The op-ed also clarified that the act would not legalize or recognize polygamous relationships or marriages, which is a right-wing media smear hurled against the bill. As Media Matters reported in August, several prominent right-wing pundits, such as Rush Limbaugh and Matt Walsh, have deployed classic homophobic rhetoric against the RFMA. That includes asserting that the act could lead to legalization of polygamy, incest, pedophilia, and bestiality, all of which is, of course, untrue. It is time for the Senate to get the job done and pass this bill to protect marriage equality and ensure that all Americans are treated fairly and equally under the law, the senators wrote. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.